That would be fine. All right, then. It's a date, Elvie said, and sat back down at the deck. Her back hurt, especially between the shoulder blades. She went through the tools screen, trying to find a way to bump the font up another level, but the deck's options were very limited. She was going to need help, and soon. In the main room, someone called out sharply, and a dozen voices rose in answering chorus of complaint. Okay, that wouldn't be fine, Fayez said. Elvie, listen, you are the smartest woman I've ever met, and I've been at some of the best universities there are. If there's anyone, anywhere, that can get us out of this, it's you. And I would very much like to grow very, very old and decrepit and probably incontinent and senile in your company. So if you could save my life and everyone else's, I'd very much appreciate it. That's sweet, and please don't put more pressure on me right now, and I'll try, warred in her mind. Somewhere at the edge of the ruins, someone shouted. She hoped it wasn't a slug, that it wasn't another death, that it wasn't something else that had gone wrong. Okay, she said. Chapter 38. Holden. Holden shuffled his way around the tower again. The sky was the iron gray of an overcast noon. The rain had tapered off to a faint drizzle, just heavy enough to keep his hair and clothes soaked and send rivulets of water down his spine. The wet ground sucked at his boot heels with each step. The air smelled of ozone and mud. A small group of death slugs were nosing at a crack in the tower's base. A wad of fabric blocked their entrance, but they were using their narrow noses to probe at it, looking for a way in. Holden hefted his long-handled shovel, recovered from the ruined mines, and smashed them flat with one heavy blow. He scooped up the gooey corpses and threw them away from the tower, then let the light rain wash the slime off the blade. He moved on, finding only the occasional straggler on the tower wall. These he scraped off and flung away using the shovel like a catapult. At first, it had been sort of fun to see how far he could throw them. Now his shoulders and arms burned with fatigue, and his distances were getting shorter and shorter. Miller followed along sometimes, not saying anything, just a gray, basset hound-faced reminder that Holden had more important things to be doing. He vanished when Holden rounded a corner and found a small work crew resting near a partially dug trench. They were trying to get at least a shallow, water-filled ditch all the way around the tower, but it was slow work with their primitive implements. This particular group was made up of three women and two men with crude digging tools. They were stretching and drinking water from one of the bags the purifier put out. One of the women gave him a nod. The other four ignored him. One of the two men had a slug on his pants. It hung on the fabric just above his right knee. There was no slime trail around it. None of the five diggers seemed to notice it was there. Holden knew that if he shouted in alarm, the man might take a swipe at it with his hand without thinking. So he calmly walked toward him and said, "Don't move." The man frowned back at him. "Okay?" Holden grabbed the man by the shoulders and shoved him onto his back. "The fuck?" the other man said. They were all backing away from him like onlookers at the start of a fight. Holden leaned over the man on the ground and repeated, "Don't move." Then he grabbed the cuffs of the man's pants and yanked them off with one hard pull. He threw them as far away as he could. "What just happened?" said the woman who'd first nodded at him. Holden recognized her now. Older, tough, one of the bosses at the mine. Probably in charge of the trench crew. "Didn't anyone see that he had a slug on his knee?" "Baba Somalo?" someone muttered. Holden reached down a hand and pulled the dazed man to his feet. "You had a death slug on your pants. Were you leaning against this wall?" "No, I don't know, maybe for a second," the man started. I told you people, Holden said, first to the man, then rotating to face the crew boss. I told you not to touch the walls. The slugs climbed them to get away from the water. The crew boss nodded at him with one fist. Sasa. You didn't see it, Holden said, not asking a question. How bad? Malo que sus ojos. Ojos? The man asked. Not ojos, orbas, eyes. Nakorocho, the man agreed with a belter shrug of his hands. Not good. Well, the price you pay for not letting your boss know you couldn't see well enough to avoid slugs is now you have no pants. Sasa. So go back inside, Holden said, giving the man a gentle shove toward the tower entrance, and see if you can find some way to cover your shame. Sorry, boss, the man replied, then trotted off. Anyone else on the crew that bad? Holden asked the team leader. She frowned and shrugged. Not great. We all missed it. All right, Holden said, rubbing his head. It sent the water clinging to his scalp and hair running down his neck. After a moment, he said, Take them all back. The trench. Too risky now. I'll stay on patrol. Get your people inside. All right, the woman said, then started leading her people toward the entrance. Holden's hand terminal buzzed at him, and when he pulled it out, he saw someone had been trying to connect for a while. He allowed the connection, and after a few seconds, Elvie appeared on the screen. Jim, where are you? I need you back at the lab. Sorry, Holden replied. Kind of busy out here. Your blood work just finished. I need you to come read me the results. The screen on the analysis rig was tiny. Who, in the age of implantable vision correctives, had bad eyesight? Holden felt he could make a usability argument to the designers now. Let me finish this patrol, Holden said. This is important. So is keeping alive the idiots who insist on working outside when they can't see. Hurry then, please, she said and killed the connection. Holden was putting his terminal away when it started pinging at him. A quick glance at the screen showed it was alerting him to another supply drop. He held the terminal up to the skyline and let it direct him to the location of the drop. A distant, white parachute popped into view as the terminal zoomed in on it. Too far. They were still coming in, randomly scattered over too wide an area. They had teams out recovering the first several drops, but pretty soon, they wouldn't have anyone left who could see far enough to make a dangerous trek out to the supplies and back. Anyone but him. He headed off to find Amos and their potential solution to that problem. The mechanic had set up his little workshop a few hundred meters away from the tower, under an A-frame shelter made of corrugated plastic sheeting. A variety of tools, salvaged electric car parts, and welding supplies littered the cramped space beneath. How's it looking? Holden asked, then walked into the shelter and sat on a plastic crate filled with odds and ends. Amos sat cross-legged on a piece of plastic surrounded by battery housings and various states of disassembly. Well, here's the problem, he said, waving at the batteries with one thick arm. As in, I got a couple carts they hauled out of the soup around the mines that I can have ready to roll in hours if I throw my back into it. Turns out they don't mind being submerged all that much. The drive assemblies need the mud cleaned out and shit. That's an easy job. But the batteries are hosed. Yeah, that's about the size of it. Amos picked up a delicate-looking strip of metal covered in rust spots. They minded. Holden took the corroded lead out of Amos's hand and looked it over for a few seconds, then tossed it on a growing pile of bad parts. The ships say high-altitude winds are making precise drops impossible, he said. Right now, I can send out search teams to track them down. Right up until your searchers can't see the piss without hitting their shoes. Right up until then. And then I'm the only person who can go get the supplies. And I can't keep up with that and everything else without some wheels. Okay, Amos said. Good news is, I think I can assemble 2 or 3 working batteries off the parts. Bad news is, I'll probably only be able to charge one. One is all I need, and a functioning cart to put it in. I can make that happen, Amos said. He slowly reached across his body and grabbed the oxyacetylene torch. It popped to life with a bright blue flame that he pointed at something on the ground. A death slug that had been creeping up on him died with a hiss and a sizzle. How are your eyes doing? Holden asked, keeping his tone casual. Okay so far, the mechanic replied. We haven't been here as long, maybe. But I can see green flaring at the edges of my vision, so I know I got the bug same as everyone else. You should be inside with the rest of us. Nah, Amos said. As he spoke, he grabbed one of the partial batteries and began pulling it apart. A lot of this salvage waste people are bringing in is leaking toxic shit you wouldn't want in the air in there. Plus, I don't want those people getting touchy-feely with my stuff. You know what I mean. The shelter you've set up makes an attractive dry spot. The slugs will be swarming you by nightfall. Maybe, Amos agreed with a nod. But I got my plastic sheet to keep them from popping up out of the ground, and the ones that try to crawl in get fried by the torch. I leave their little smoking corpses out there. The live ones seem to avoid them. I think I'm okay. Holden nodded and sat with Amos in companionable silence for a few minutes, while the mechanic finished stripping the battery and laying out the parts based on how damaged they were. He was building a pile of clean parts to assemble new battery housings out of. Holden knew if he offered to help, he'd just get in the way, but it was so nice to be both out of the rain and out of sight of the anxious colonists that he didn't want to leave. You know, he finally said, if your eyes get much worse, I'm going to have to make you come inside. Finished with this or not. I guess you can try, Amos said with a laugh. Don't fight me on this, Holden said. Please. Can I have one thing no one is fighting me on? I'm not leaving you out here to get poisoned. And if you're blind, I think I can take you. Might be fun to find out, Amos laughed again. If it's anybody, it's you, I guess. But I'm not being obstinate to be a pain in your ass, Cap. I hope you know that. Then what? Everybody in there has the same fucking problem. Running out of food, going blind, planet blew up, Amos said. He began assembling a battery out of spare parts while he spoke. His deft fingers knew the work so well he almost didn't have to look at it. Know what they'll be talking about? That? Yeah. Boo-hoo. I ain't got no food. I'm going blind. Holy shit, there's poison slugs. I don't do group therapy. Couple minutes of bitching and moaning, I'm gonna start knocking people out just to get some peace. Holden slumped on the crate, putting his soggy head in his hands. I know. I get to listen to that instead. It's making me a little cranky. You're cranky because you're tired, Amos said. You got that I have to save everyone hang up, so I make it that you haven't slept in about 2 days. But listening to people bitch, yeah, that's sort of your job. That's why you make the big money. We make the same money. Then I guess you're doing it for the fame and glory. I hate you, Holden said. I'll have that first cart up and running by the end of the day, Amos replied, snapping the battery housing together with a plastic click. Thanks, Holden said, then pushed himself to his feet with a grunt and started slogging his way back toward the tower. Anytime, Amos said to his back. Holden's terminal started buzzing again.
Jim, where are you?
Elvie said the moment he accepted the connection.
I need this data.
On my way, he replied. Sort of wearing a lot of hats right now, but I should be there in a minute. He killed the connection just in time for Murtry to come out of the tower's main entrance and make him a liar. Captain, Murtry said. Mr. Murtry, how are things on your end? Amos seems to be making good use of the salvaged carts. He's a good mechanic, the RCE security chief replied. There was another drop. Saw it. My terminal marked and mapped it. Let me transfer the location so you can send a team. As he transferred the data, Murtry said,
We lost a man.
Who?
Paulson, one of my drivers. Slug crawled into his boot when no one was looking.
I'm very sorry, Holden said, trying to remember if he knew which one Paulson was, and feeling guilty that someone had died to help them out and he couldn't even put a face with the name.
Stupid mistake, Murtry said.
He tapped out some rapid commands on his terminal.
And I wasn't looking for your sympathy, just apprising you of the situation and our reduced team strength.
Okay, Holden said, surprised that the man's lack of empathy still surprised him.
Way will handle the supply pickup.
How's her vision doing? How many more of these runs does she have in her, do you think?
She's on her way, Murtry said with a humorless smile. So at least one more, I'd say.
Great, Holden said. Tell her I said thanks.
Will do, Murtry replied, ignoring the irony. But I need something from you.
You need, or RCE needs?
Consider those the same thing at this point, Murtry said. Should be some construction materials in this load. I need to assemble a work crew to set up my structure before everyone is too blind to do the job.
What's it for? There's a ton of other work we need to do while we can, and in a turn of luck, Holden said, pointing at the alien tower behind him, shelter is not one of our pressing problems.
These people, Murtry said, are eating my food, drinking my water, and taking my medicine. My team is gathering the supplies and doing the dangerous salvage work that makes any of this possible. You know what? As long as that remains true, they can throw up a few walls for me when I ask.
Then what do you need from me?
They have the mistaken impression you're in charge. Correcting them seemed impolite.
Holden had a sudden mental image of dragging the soon-to-be-blind Murtry out into the middle of the rain-soaked desert and abandoning him at the center of a swarm of lethal slugs.
Did I say something funny? Murtry asked.
Inside joke, Holden replied with a smile. You had to be there. I'll let Carol know you're looking for volunteers. Before Murtry could object, Holden turned and walked away. Inside, the tower was a buzzing hive of activity as the colonists hurried to finish their last preparations for the coming long night. Lucia had a group working to fill everything that could hold water with supplies from the chemistry deck. Carol Chiwiwi was leading a team through the interior of the tower, hunting out any remaining death slugs and plugging any holes they could find. Holden climbed a ramp, and then a set of steps made out of empty packing crates to reach the third floor of the tower. Inside the chamber they'd optimistically named the lab, he found Elvi, Faez, and a third member of the RCE science team, whom Holden thought was named Sudyam.
Who is that?
Elvi asked. She poked Faez in the bicep. Is that Jim? Faez squinted at him for a second, then said,
Finally.
Sorry I was late, but Murtry wanted...
I need you to come read this,
Elvi said over the top of him. She was pointing at the chemistry deck's small screen. Holden walked over and looked at the display, but had no idea what any of the confusion of symbols and acronyms meant.
What am I looking for?
First we want to check the CBC, Elvi said, coming over to point at the screen.
Nothing on it said CBC.
Okay, Holden said, will it say CBC? I don't see CBC here.
Elvi sighed, then began speaking slowly.
Does the screen say results at the top?
No, it says tools at the very top, is that what you mean?
Wrong menu. Hit the back button, Elvi said, pointing at a button on the screen.
Holden pushed it.
Oh, I see a results option now.
Hit that, then we're going to be looking for numbers on the CBC, RBC, WBC, hemoglobin, hematocrit, and platelet count readouts.
Hey, Holden said happily, I see all that stuff.
Tell us what they are.
Holden did so while Elvi made notes on her terminal.
She had the display blown up to the point where Holden could read it from across the room.
"Back up now and let's look at blood gases," she said when they were done.
It took over an hour, but in the end Holden had given them all the results they were looking for. They decided to take some more of his blood and let him go. When they were done, he stood next to Elvie, pressing a scrap of bandage against the puncture wound.
"Are we any closer?"
"It's not an easy process," she replied. "Even with access to all these mines and the Israel's computer, we're looking for a needle in a complex organism."
"How much time do we have left?"
Elvie tilted her head up so the light shone into her pupils. Holden could see the faint green tinge there.
"Almost none," she said. "But you should go get some sleep. You're exhausted."
"My blood told you that?"
"You haven't slept in 2 days," she said with a laugh. "Math tells me that."
"I promise I'll hit the rack as soon as I can," he lied to her. He climbed down the makeshift steps and the weirdly alien curve of the ramp to the tangle of people at the ground floor. Lucia turned over water duty to her assistants and was shining a penlight into the eyes of a small child. She gave Holden a tired smile as he walked by. Someone gave an alarmed shout, then rushed through the room carrying a slug on a stick and threw it outside. Holden followed it outside and stomped on it. The sky was darkening to the color of damp ash, and the rain was becoming heavier. Distant thunder rumbled to the east, the lightning visible only as dim flashes in the heavy clouds. The air smelled of ozone and mud. Holden shuffled his way around the tower again. Chapter 39. Baja.
"Hey, Papa,"
the Yasek on the screen said. The boy's voice almost vibrated with fear and exhaustion.
"Hey, son,"
the recorded Baja and the real one said at the same time. Yasek began talking about death slugs and lightning and living in the alien ruins, reciting words of reassurance and explanation that Baja could recognize as Lucia's. Yasek soberly repeated all the reasons his mother had given him that things might end well, telling Baja as an excuse to hear them again himself. It was the third time Baja had watched the recorded video of his conversation with his boy. When it finished, he queued up the recording of his conversation with Lucia and watched it for the 10th time. He considered asking Alex to call them again, get new conversations to record, but he recognized this as a selfish impulse and quashed it. Yasek looked dirty, covered with mud, tired. He described the horror of the poisonous slug worms with dread and fascination. The constant lightning storms and rain were amazingly exotic to a child who'd only ever lived in ice tunnels and ship holds before coming to Illis. He never said he wished his daddy was there, but the fact sang in his words. Baja wanted nothing more than to take his boy by the hand, tell him it was all right to be scared, that bravery was being scared and doing it anyway. Lucia, when her turn had come, looked less fearful than exhausted. Her smiles for him were all perfunctory. Her report was vague because he knew she had nothing to say that would help either of them to hear. Felcia's videos had been the ones that brought him peace. She was the one member of his family he had felt like he hadn't failed. She'd wanted to go to school, and he'd managed to push down his fears and needs and the burdens that he carried long enough to actually let her go. It had felt like a victory. Until now. Now he only saw the ticking clock Alex had left running, showing the remaining time until she burned up across Illis's sky. The simulation and timer ran out their terrible program on the panel behind him. He tried never to look. When he needed to use the screens on the operations deck, he drifted through the compartment, trying not to even glance in its direction. He tried very hard to forget that it existed at all. He failed. Watching his most recent conversation with Felsia for the fourth time, he felt the timer behind him, like a warm spot on his back, like the stare of someone from across a crowded room. The game became how long he could go without looking, or whether he could distract himself sufficiently to forget it was there. On the screen, Felsia told him about learning to change air scrubbers on the Belter freighter. It wasn't the sort of thing she'd had to do in the long months when the Barba Pecola had been their home. Her graceful fingers were demonstrating some complex function necessary to the process. She made it seem light, fun, amusing. He was her father. He knew that she was scared. Tick, tick, tick. The clock burned soundlessly at his back. He adjusted the air recycling system nozzle near his panel and sent a cool breeze across his face. He finished the recording and spent some time organizing his files by content and date, then decided it was better by date and name, and reorganized them again. Tick, tick, tick. Hot like the sun on a dark shirt at noon. Burning without burning. He opened up the file Alex had set up with repair tasks and scrolled through the list. He'd already checked off the ones he was actually capable of doing. They spent some time looking over the rest of the items, trying to decide if there were any he could help out with. Nothing jumped out at him. Not surprising, since it was his fifth time through the list. Tick, tick, tick. Baja turned around. The first thing he noticed was that the simulated orbital paths looked different. The changes were so slight that he probably shouldn't have been able to see them, but the bright, hateful lines that described his only daughter's demise had burned themselves into his brain. There was no doubt. They were different. For some reason, it took him longer to notice that the clock had changed. There were three fewer days. Last time he'd looked at the clock, just a few hours before, there had been slightly over 8 days on it. Now, there were just under five. "The clock is broken," he said to no one. Alex was up in the cockpit, where he seemed to spend most of his time. Baja yanked at the straps, holding him to the chair, fighting with them without success until he forced himself to calm down and just press the release latches. Then he kicked off to the crew ladder and climbed up. Alex had a complex-looking graphic on his main display. He was working at it with gentle touches on the screen and a steady stream of muttering under his breath. "The timer's wrong," Baja said. If it weren't for the fact that he found himself inexplicably out of breath, he probably would have yelled it. "Hmm?" Alex swiped at the panel and shifted to a graph filled with numbers. He began entering new figures into it. "The clock, the orbital timer thing, is broken." "Working on it right now," Alex said. "It ain't broke." "It's down to 5 days." "Yeah," Alex said, then stopped working to rotate his chair and look at Baja. "I was going to talk to you about that." Baja felt all the strength go out of him. If there had been gravity, he would have slumped to the floor on legs made out of rubber. "It's right?"
"It is,"
the pilot said, swiping the screen behind him again to get back to the graphical display.
"But it ain't unexpected. The initial estimates about their batteries were gonna change. They were back of the napkin kind of shit to start with."
"I don't understand," Baja said. His stomach had clenched tight. If he'd bothered to eat anything in the last day or two, he'd probably have vomited.
"The first estimate was based on orbital distance, ship mass, and expected battery life versus consumption."
As Alex spoke, he pointed at various places on his graph, as though that explained anything. As though the graph made any sense.
"Orbital decay is just not something anyone worries about when the reactors are on. If any of us had wanted to, we could have built orbits that were damn near permanent. But the Barb's got that shuttle going up and down with the ore, so she went kind of low. Save a little on each trip. And forgive me for saying it, she's a flying hunk of shit.
heavier than she should be, and batteries dying fast. So, the new numbers. Baja floated next to the gunner's seat, watching the hateful math spool out across the screen.
She lost 3 days, he finally said when he found the breath to do it. 3 days.
No, she never had those days to start with, Alex replied. His words were harsh, brutal, but his face was sad and kind. I haven't forgotten my promise. If the barb goes down, your little girl will be on this ship when it happens.
Thank you, Baja said.
I'm going to call the captain right now. We'll work up a plan. Just give me some time. Can you do that?
5 days, Baja thought. I have 5 days to give you.
Yes, he said instead.
Okay, Alex said, and waited expectantly for Baja to leave.
When he didn't, the pilot shrugged and turned around to call up the comm display.
Captain, Alex here, come in.
Holden here, the familiar voice said a few seconds later.
So, ran the updated numbers like you asked. We're definitely losing the barb first.
How bad? The captain asked. His connection seemed fuzzy.
It took Baja a moment to realize it was the sound of rain. Just under 5 days until she starts scraping on more atmo than she can handle.
Damn it, Holden said, then nothing.
The silence went on long enough that Baja started to worry they'd lost their connection.
How's the Rosi?
Oh, we're fine. Pretty much everything's off but the lights and the air. Lots of slack.
Can we help?
Like, Alex said, dragging the word out, give him a tow?
Like that. What can we do?
Boss, Alex said, hooking two ships together like that can be done, but doing it in low orbit ain't a trivial problem. I'm just a pilot. Sure would be nice if we had, you know, our engineer back to run those numbers.
Yeah, no kidding, Holden said.
He sounded angry to Baja. That was good. Angry was good. Baja found himself oddly comforted by the idea that someone other than him was upset by the situation.
Any chance on that?
Alex prompted.
Let me chat with Murtry again, Holden said. I'll call back soon. Holden out.
Alex sighed, his lips pressed thin.
Talking's not going to work, Baja said. Is it?
I don't see how, Alex said.
Which means there's a non-zero chance that we'll wind up needing to go get her ourselves.
You know there's only two of us. You and me. That's it.
There's three of us, Alex said, patting the control panel.
Don't forget, we've got the Rosi.
Baja nodded, waited for his gut to clench up again. Was surprised to find he felt a warm sense of peace flowing through him.
What will I need to do?
This is an LVA suit,
Alex said, pointing to the equipment secured in an open locker. They were on the airlock deck, which, other than the airlock, consisted almost entirely of lockers and storage closets. The contents of that particular locker looked like a rubber bodysuit with lots of attachments.
LVA?
L-V-A. Light vacuum armor. Lets you move around outside with enough air and shielding to keep you breathing, and mostly unradiated in normal applications.
Alex pulled the rubber-looking suit out and left it floating next to the locker for Baja to examine.
Self-sealing in case of puncture, with life support and injury sensors and basic medical supplies built in.
He then pulled out a red, metallic-looking breastplate.
It also keeps you from getting too many holes poked in you by small arms fire.
As Alex pulled out each piece and showed it to Baja, explaining its function, Baja dutifully examined them and made what he hoped were appropriate noises. He'd worn vacuum suits for work almost his entire adult life. Their form and function were well known to him, but the various pieces of armor and technology that made the suit into a weapon of war were outside his experience.
certainly something Alex described as automatic IFF and hostile tracking available through the HUD display, sounded impressive and useful, but Baja had no idea for what. So he nodded his head and looked thoughtful and examined the helmet when Alex handed it to him.
"You ever fired a gun?"
Alex asked when the armor had all been pulled out of the locker.
"Never," Baja said.
He had a brief, vivid memory of the assault on the RCE security team, of the horrible injuries the gunshots left, of the surprised looks on their faces as they died. Baja waited for the nausea to start, but still felt only the warmth and calm.
"Held one once. Pretty sure I didn't fire it."
"This," Alex said, holding up a thick black pistol, "is a 7.5mm semi-automatic handgun. 25-round magazine, standard sidearm of the MCRN. It's fairly idiot-proof, so this will be the one I send you in with."
"If I go in at all," Baja said.
"Sure," Alex agreed with a smile.
"Don't really have a range to practice on here, but you can dry fire it a few times to get the feel. Honestly, though, if you get over there and need to be dead-eyed dick to make it back, you're pretty much fucked."
"Why carry it at all, then?"
"Because people do what you want them to do when you point one of these at them," Alex said.
"Might as well be empty, then," Baja said, taking the gun from him and waving it through the air to feel the weight.
"If you want," Alex replied.
"No, show me what to do. Then let's load it. For Felsia. I can do it for her."
"Okay,"
Alex said, then proceeded to do just that. Holden called back several hours later. When he spoke, his voice was tight, angry.
"Holden here. Murtry isn't going to bend an inch, so fuck him. Go get Naomi back. Out."
"Well," Alex said, dragging the word out to a long sigh. "That's it. I think we're officially not mediators anymore."
Baja nodded with his fist, causing his body to rotate slightly. They were floating on the ops deck. The various pieces of the disassembled pistol hung in the air next to Baja. Alex had insisted that he know how to take the gun apart and put it back together again. Baja had no idea why that would be important, but had gone along with it anyway.
"What now?" he asked.
"Better start putting that back together. I'll pull the Israel specs up again and we can give them one last look. Remember, stuff gets moved around on a working ship. Things ain't always where the standard blueprints say they are. You're gonna want to alternate ingress and egress points in case someone sealed off a corridor you wanted to use."
"I have a good memory," Baja said.
It sounded like a brag, but it was true. He'd grown up in corridors and hallways. His sense of direction was excellent.
"That'll help. Then we get you suited up and I drop you off," Alex said, then paused. "But there's one issue we haven't discussed. I got plenty of juice to get you over there, and the Rosi can make sure no one messes with you in space, but I can't get you inside."
Baja surprised himself by laughing.
"Something funny?"
Alex said, raising an eyebrow at him.
"Funny that you're worried about the only part of this where I actually know what I'm doing," Baja said. "I'm a licensed Class 3 vacuum welder. I weld in space. You find me a ship I can't cut my way into. Just try."
"Alrighty," Alex said and gave him a light slap on one shoulder. "Let's get to work."
Baja drifted away from the Rosinante. Instead of a simple vacuum suit and air supply, he wore state-of-the-art Martian-made light combat armor. Instead of walking across the hull of the ship on magnetic boots, he moved across half a dozen kilometers of vacuum on gentle puffs of compressed nitrogen. Below his feet, Illis spun, an angry, gray world wrapped in storms and flashing constantly with high-altitude lightning. Lucia and Jacek were down there,
under all that atmospheric rage. But he couldn't do anything to help them. So, he would help the person he could. He would save Naomi from the RCE ship, and she would save his daughter. There were a lot of holes in that logic that he carefully avoided thinking about. He drifted closer to a massive island of gray metal in the darkness. The Edward Israel, the enemy.
"You okay out there?"
Alex said over the comm. The helmet's small speakers flattened his voice. There was also an aggressive background hiss to it.
"Fine. Everything is green."
Alex had shown him how to page through the status indicators on the suit's heads-up display, and Baja was dutifully checking them every few minutes.
"So I'm making all sorts of angry demands for the release of Naomi," Alex said. "Got the Israel locked up with a targeting laser, and I'm flooding their sensors with radio noise and light scatter. Should keep their eyes, what eyes they got left, firmly planted on the Rossi. Give you a minute or two before they realize you're cutting your way in."
"That doesn't sound like very long," Baja said.
"Cut fast. Alex out."
Alex had reassured him that the Rocinante had plenty of battery power, that shooting lasers and blasting out radio jamming wouldn't affect it much. But Baja had come to view power as a precious and irreplaceable resource. Not something he'd ever needed to do in the age of readily available fusion. It gave everything a sense of permanence it hadn't had before. No do-overs. No, we'll get it right next time. He checked his course toward the Israel's midship maintenance airlock, found it good, and pulled out his welding torch, holding it in a white-knuckle grip. The ship swelled until it blocked his view in every direction. The airlock hatch resolving from a tiny, slightly lighter dot to a thumbnail-sized square to an actual door with a small, round window in it. The pre-programmed EVA pack fired off a long blast of nitrogen in four cones of vapor, and he drifted to a gentle stop a meter away. The welding rig came to life with a burst of bright blue fire. "Here I come," Baja said to Naomi, and to the RCE people guarding her, and to his baby girl, thousands of kilometers away on her dying ship. "Here I come." Chapter 40, Havelock.
"I've shut down everything I can," Marwick said on the screen. "Sensors, lights, entertainments. I've dialed back the cooling. With the batteries being what they are, I'll give us just under 17 days. And that's with the solar collectors up at full. Less than that if they start failing. After that, it'll be time to decide whether we'd rather suffocate or burn."
Havelock rubbed his forefinger and thumb deep into his eye sockets. He hadn't gone to the gym, and he was trying to make up for it by increasing the cocktail of Null-G steroids. It wasn't a long-term fix, but the more he looked at it, the less it seemed like he'd need one of those. It did give him a headache, though. If it hadn't been for Naomi, he wouldn't have spent as much time exercising as he had. Something to thank her for. His office felt stuffy and close, and the temperature was climbing steadily. As a boy living planetside, he'd always thought of space as cold, and while that was technically true, mostly it was a vacuum. And so a ship, mostly, was a thermos. The heat from their bodies and systems would bleed off into the void over years or decades if it had the chance. If he could find a way to get them the chance. "Have we mentioned it to the crew?" he asked.
"I haven't, but the data's hard to keep secret. Especially when it's a can full of scientists and engineers with little enough else to do. We're going to need to talk about dropping them, as many as we can. So that they can starve and die on the planet if the moons don't shoot them down."
"Most part, yes," Marwick said. "They've come a long way not to put a foot on the surface. There's more than one I know would prefer dying there."
In her cage, Naomi coughed. "I'll talk to Mercury.
Havelock said. Having a graveyard on the planet might be something he'd want, especially if we could get more bodies in it than the squatters have. Marwick sighed. He'd stopped shaving, and when he rubbed his chin, it sounded like someone throwing a handful of sand at a window.
We came close, though, didn't we? All the way out here to start the whole damned world up again?
We saw the promised land, Havelock said. What about the Baba Picola? What's her situation?
It makes ours look good. That lithium ore is going to be a high atmosphere vapor in a little over 4 days.
Well, I guess we won't need to worry about stopping them from taking it back to the market.
Problem's about to solve itself, Marwick agreed. But to the point. Security? These people are facing a death they can't fight and they can't flee from. They're going to get crazy if we don't do something. And neither you nor I have the manpower to stop them if things get out of control.
What would it matter? Havelock wanted to say. Let them riot. It won't change how long before we hit air. Not even by a minute.
I hear you, he said. I do have the security override codes. I'll have the autodoc add a little tranquilizer and mood stabilizer, maybe some euphorics to everyone's cocktail. I don't want to do much, though. I need these people thinking straight, not dope to the gills.
If that's how you want to play it.
I'm not putting the ship on hospice. Not yet.
The captain's shrug was eloquent, and left nothing more to say. Havelock dropped the connection. The screen went to its default. Despair rushed up over him like a rogue wave. They had done everything right, and it didn't matter. They were all going to die. All the people he'd come to help protect, all the people on his team, his prisoner, himself, everyone. They were going to die, and there wasn't anything he could do about it but get them high before it happened. He didn't know he was going to punch the screen until he'd already done it. The panel shifted in its seating a little, but he hadn't left a mark on it. The gimbals of his crash couch hissed as they absorbed the momentum. He'd split his knuckle. A drop of blood welled on his skin, growing to the size of a dark red marble, the surface tension pulling it out along his skin as he watched. When he moved, he left a spray of droplets hanging in the air like little planets and moons.
You know, Naomi said, if you're looking at hundreds of people burning to death as a problem solving itself, that may be more evidence that you're on the wrong side.
We didn't plant the bombs, Havelock said. That was them. They started it.
Does that matter to you?
At this point? Not as much as it probably should. Naomi was floating close to her cage door. He was always amazed at a belter's capacity to endure small spaces. Probably claustrophobia had been selected out of their gene pool. He wondered how many generations of Naomi's family had lived up the well.
You're bleeding, she said.
Yep, that's not going to matter much either.
You know you could let me out. I'm a very good engineer, and I have the best ship out here. Get me back to the Rossi, and I may be able to figure out a way to make things better.
Not going to happen.
And here I thought it didn't matter to you, she said with a smile in her voice. I don't know how you can be so calm about all this. It's what I do when I'm scared. And really, you should let me out.
Havelock gathered the blood out of the air. His knuckle had scabbed over already. He logged into the autodock with the sick sense of taking the first step toward giving up, but it had to be done. A crew full of panicking people wasn't going to make anything better, especially since the closest thing he had to a full staff was down on the planet with Murtry. Havelock's news feeds from back home were filled with hyperbolic pieces about the tragedy at New Terra. The sensor data of the explosion had found its way to a few of the reputable feeds, but there were also three or four other forged versions out there, too. The faked data wasn't particularly more impressive than the truth. He spooled through a dozen commentators. Some of them seemed angry that the expedition had been allowed to go out. Some were somber and sad.
None of them seemed to think there was much chance of anyone surviving. His message queue had over 1,000 new entries. People in the media, people from the Home Office, a few, just a few, from people he'd known. An old lover from when he was at Pinkwater, a cousin he hadn't seen in a decade and a half who was living on Ceres Station now, a couple of classmates from school. There was nothing like dying publicly on a few billion screens to help reconnect with folks. He wasn't going to answer any of them, not even the ones from his employers, not even the ones from his friends. All of it felt like he was trapped underwater and drowning, looking up at the water's surface and knowing he'd never make it there. He undid his straps. "Good night, Havelock," Naomi said. "I'll be back," he said, launching himself across the office. It had been a long time since he'd done a patrol, even just an informal one. He pulled himself along the narrow corridors of the Israel, moved through the common spaces, commissary, gym, open lab, bar. In the months, years now, that he'd lived on the Israel, it had become invisible the way that any place did. Looking at it now was like seeing it for the first time. It was an old ship. The carefully symmetrical shape of the corridors, the keyed mechanism on the doorways. All of it was the kind of thing he'd seen in pictures of his grandparents. Seeing the people was much the same. There was a distance between security and the rest of the crew. If there wasn't, then something had gone badly wrong. Havelock didn't think of himself as being part of the Israel's complement, but every face he passed, he recognized. Hosni McCarron, the food science head. Anita Chang, systems tech. John DeLosso, mechanic. Even if he didn't know how he knew them, they were all part of the context of his life now. And they were all going to die, because he couldn't stop it from happening. Forward observation was a dark room. The screens were built to give the illusion of looking out a window at the vastness of space, but no one ever actually used it that way. When he came in, it was empty. The screens were filled with sensor data spooling past too quickly to read. A musical composition by a dark-skinned belter he didn't recognize, and a false-color temperature map of New Terra. The security camera had a bit of cloth tacked over it, and the air recyclers hadn't quite managed to clear out the smell of marijuana. Probably someone had been using it as a meeting place for sex. Havelock pulled the cloth free of the camera. Well, and why shouldn't they? It wasn't as if anything they did now was going to matter in 3 weeks. He shifted the screens to show the planet below them. New Terra, wrapped in clouds. No lights. No cities. No sign of the small, struggling human presence. The planet that had killed them all. And still, it was beautiful. His hand terminal buzzed. The red border of the incoming connection meant it was a security alert. Adrenaline hit his bloodstream and set his heart racing even before he turned it on. Marwick and Murtry were already in the middle of a conversation when he dropped in. "Many of them, and I don't care to find out now," Marwick said, shouted almost. Murtry's expression seemed angry and dismissive, but Havelock realized it was only that he wasn't looking into the camera. He couldn't see it. "What's going on?" Havelock asked. "The Rosinante is targeting us," Marwick said. Havelock was already pushing himself off, moving fast through the corridor. "Are they making demands?" "Backed up by threats," Marwick said, throwing up his arms. "That's hyperbole," Murtry said. "They're painting the Israel with their targeting lasers, and some mad bastard's cutting through the midship maintenance airlock." "We're being boarded?" Havelock said. He couldn't keep the incredulity from his voice. "By who? What's the point?" "Motivation's not our concern right now," Murtry said. "Our priority is making sure the security of the ship is maintained." Havelock grabbed a handhold at the intersection of two corridors and spun himself down, feet first, toward the junction that would get him back to his desk. All respect, sir, you know they've got to be after the prisoner. Why don't we just give her to them? It's not like it's going to matter.
Murtry tilted his head. His smile was thin and cruel.
You're suggesting that we release the saboteur?
We're all dead anyway, Havelock said. And then there it was, spoken aloud. The one thing that all of them were thinking. All of them but Murtry.
You were immortal before we shipped out?
He asked, his voice dry and cold as a rattlesnake.
Because whether you're planning to die next week or 7 decades from now, there's still a way we do this.
Yes, sir, Havelock said as he reached the last turning and hauled himself down toward his office. Sorry, sir. The connection chimed as someone else joined. The chief engineer was grim-faced and angry in a way that Havelock immediately distrusted.
Reporting for duty, Kernan said.
Wait, what's he doing here? Havelock said.
I've included your militia in this, Murtry said as Havelock slid into his office. If we're repelling boarders, we're going to need them.
My men are ready, the chief engineer said, not missing a beat. Just let us know where the sons of bitches are coming through, and we'll be there to meet them.
Oh, God, Havelock thought. He's talking like he's in a movie. This is a terrible idea.
Mr. Havelock, Murtry said, I'm going to ask you to open the live ammunition supply to the militia forces.
With respect, sir, Havelock said, I don't think that's a good idea. This isn't like a paintball exercise. We're looking at a real fight, the risk of friendly fire alone.
Murtry's voice was calm and cool and viciously cutting.
Do I understand, Mr. Havelock, that you've done such a poor job training these men that you feel we'd be safer repelling the attackers with paintballs?
No, sir, Havelock said. And then, to his surprise, but I am saying issuing live rounds at this point would be premature. I think we should find out a little more about what we're looking at before we escalate that far.
That's your professional opinion? Murtry said.
It is.
And if I ordered you to issue these men live rounds?
Naomi was at her cage, her fingers clutching at the mesh. Her eyes were wide and serious. Havelock looked away from her. Murtry's sigh was short and percussive.
Well, I won't put you in a position where you have to choose, Murtry said.
Chief?
Yes, sir, the chief engineer said.
I'm transmitting you my personal security codes. You can take weapons and ammunition from the armory with it. Do you understand?
Hell yes, sir, the chief engineer said. We'll poke those bastards so full of holes you can see stars through them.
I'd appreciate that, Murtry said. Now, if you gentlemen will excuse me.
The connection dropped.
What's going on? Naomi asked. The warm tone was gone from her voice. Now she actually sounded scared. Or maybe angry, he couldn't tell. Havelock didn't answer. The armory was off the main security station, not the brig. Even if he hurried, he wouldn't be able to get there before the others. And if he did, he didn't know what he'd say to them. He had a gun cabinet here. Maybe if he joined in, he could at least control the situation a little bit.
Havelock, what's going on?
We're being boarded, and we're going to resist.
Is it the Barba Piccola?
No, it's the Rocinante.
They're coming for me, then?
I assume so.
Havelock took a shotgun out of the gun cabinet.
If it's Alex and you shoot him, it won't help you, Naomi said. No matter what happens after this, if he's hurt, we're done. Even if I find a way to save you, I'll let you burn.
The monitor chimed. A connection request from the planet. Havelock accepted it immediately. Dr. Okoya's face appeared on the screen. Her forehead furrowed and her eyes shifting as if she was looking for something. There was actually a glint of green in her pupils that made Havelock's skin crawl.
Mr. Havelock, are you there?
I'm afraid it's not a good time, Doctor.
You're coordinating the drops? I need to see if we can get-
Is this something where people are going to die if I don't fix it in the next 5 minutes?
5 minutes? No,